If You Give a Rake, a Ruby. Written by Shayna Galen. Narrated by Lucy Rivers. Copyright 2013 by Shayna Galen. This unabridged audiobook is published by arrangement with Casablanca, an imprint of Source Books Incorporated, and was produced in the year 2013 by Tantor Media Incorporated, which holds the copyright thereto. Cytherean Intelligence Column, Morning Chronicle. And so our flaxen-haired Duchess of Dalliance exits the scene with her dangerous duke and becomes a duchess in truth. We suppose this is the last mention of her we will make in this lowly column, as we are concerned with the doings of the Demimonde, not the Haute Ton. Now to the question on everyone's lips. Who will snare the next gentleman of the Ton? Perhaps one of the two remaining diamonds will set the parson's mousetrap for an earl, or even a marquis. The ladies of society flirt and simper with newfound desperation, fearing their ranks will be further sullied. And fear they should. Lately, one cannot but note the ravishing marchioness of mystery has been courted by none other than the Duke of E., Lord K., and even H.R.H. Could the gypsy queen be our next English queen? Not if the Princess of W. has anything to say about it. But who is this dark-eyed, enigmatic beauty? From whence does she hail? One dear source insists she is the daughter of a fallen Maharaja. O fair Fallon, we beg one paltry clue. We shall feast on the rumour crumbs from your table for weeks. Diamonds are the hardest natural substances on earth. 1. Lord Quirley, Fallon said with a pointed look at the bracket clock on the brass inlaid drawing-room table. The hour grows late, and I would like to go to bed. Quirley smiled suggestively, and Fallon's upper lip itched to curl in disgust. But she controlled the impulse, as she had been taught, and imagined Lady Sinclair nodding in approval.
"Why, Marchioness, that was my thought exactly."
He rose and held out his hand, seemingly unfazed by Fallon's icy stare. Quirley was not a small man. He was tall, well-built, and handsome in the most conventional way. Fallon could understand why the Ton insisted on pairing the two of them. Quirley, with his dark hair, dark eyes, and tanned skin, complemented her own dark features perfectly. His height was better suited to Juliet, who was tall and willowy. Fallon was petite, which was Lady Sinclair's polite way of saying she was short. Fallon did not mind her diminutive size. It meant others often underestimated her, and that usually worked to her advantage. Not tonight.
"Why don't you show me to your boudoir, Fallon?"
Fallon raised a brow. "You overstep yourself, my lord. I have not given you leave to use my Christian name, nor have I expressed any interest in taking you to my bed."
"You're a courtesan," Quirley said, his eyes narrowing in annoyance. "You're paid to take men to your bed."
Fallon was still sitting, Quirley still standing, and her neck was beginning to ache from looking up at him. What a boorish lout! Or, as her bastard of a father would have said, what a bloody clodpole! How dare Quirley stand when she, a lady, was seated? Simple, she supposed. He did not consider her a lady. Very well, then. She rose.
"My lord, you are exceedingly arrogant."
He laughed, which was not unexpected, but certainly not the response she'd hoped for. He was going to make this difficult. She rolled her shoulders. Perhaps difficult was not such a bad thing,
she needed to keep in good form.
"And you are exceedingly coy,"
Quirly said, stepping closer.
"I had not expected as much. In fact, I have been led to believe you are quite the tigress in bed. Roar!"
He lifted his hands to make claws.
"Unfortunately, my lord, you will never know. Shall I ring for my butler to show you out, or can you find the way yourself?"
Quirly lowered his hands.
"I don't think you understand, Fallon."
"I've told you not to address me as such, my lord."
"I am the most sought-after man in London. I am doing you a favour by becoming your lover."
"Really? The only woman I know seeking your favour is your wife. And, if I'm not mistaken, she is quite heavy with your child at present. Do you not think you should be home with Lady Quirly?"
He took a step toward her.
"My wife is my business."
"Then I suggest you attend to your business, my lord. Good night."
She turned and strolled toward the drawing-room doors. She knew she would not reach them unmolested. She also knew she could ring for Titus. But that would be too easy. Quirly was slower than she'd anticipated, and she had almost gained the towering mahogany doors before he caught her elbow and spun her around.
"Not so fast," he began.
Fallon kicked him in the belly, sending him sprawling backward. He knocked over a pedestal holding a jeweled lamp, and she had a moment's worry because it was one of her favorites. But a quick glance reassured her the lamp was not broken. The glance also revealed Quirly was getting up.
Blockhead. "Go home, my lord. I don't want to hurt you."
"Really?"
He wiped his hands on his breeches.
"Because I would like to hurt you. I don't know who you think you are, but you're going to pay for—"
She sidestepped him, spun, and booted him in his lower back. The blow set him off balance, and she had a moment to grab a book and hurl it at him. Her aim was perfect, and the book's spine hit him in the center of the forehead.
"Ow! You little bitch!"
He charged her, and Fallon shook her head. He wasn't even thinking, simply acting blindly. She easily sidestepped him again, and he rammed into a settee, knocking it over. While he struggled to rise, Fallon dug her heel into the back of his neck and pressed him down.
"Had enough?" she asked.
"Or would you prefer to go another round?" Because she was tired and wanted to go to bed, she ground her heel into his neck.
"Enough,"
he mumbled.
"Good."
Without lifting her heel, she reached for a little silver bell and rang it. The sound tinkled softly in the room, and the drawing-room doors opened immediately to reveal Titus. Titus was close to 7 feet tall and easily 25 stone. He had a thick head of bright red hair, shocking blue eyes, and a mouth full of crooked teeth. His hands were as big as puppies, and his legs tree trunks. He did not walk so much as lumber, and Quirly began protesting the moment Titus entered the room.
"There's been some sort of mistake. I didn't intend any disrespect."
Fallon sighed.
"Titus, I might have known you would be standing right outside."
The giant shrugged, his shoulders small mountains.
"I like to make sure there's no trouble, m'lady."
Fallon had told him 100 times she was no lady, but he insisted on referring to her as such anyway. Who was she to protest? It wasn't as though anyone else was clamoring to call her a lady. She pressed her foot into Quirly's neck for good measure, then lifted it and stepped away.
"Would you be so kind as to show Lord Quirly out?"
"I'll show him out,"
Titus said,
"but I won't be kind about it."
Quirly gave her a panicked look, and Fallon was sorely tempted to shrug helplessly. but at the last moment she took pity on the man.
"Titus, be nice. Don't throw Lord Quirley farther than the lamp-post."
She strode out of the drawing-room, listening to Quirley sputter and then plead for mercy. Titus was a gentle giant to anyone he loved. He was an ogre to anyone who but looked askance at someone he loved. But she couldn't feel too sorry for Quirley. Her father, she hoped he burned in hell, always said, "When you started feeling sorry for those who want to take advantage of you, then you've gone soft and deserve what you get." Of course, he hadn't said it quite that politely. She lifted her skirts and climbed the stairs, nodded to Mary, one of the chambermaids, and blew out a long sigh. She was exhausted. The past few days had been grueling. She'd been to one social event after another, balls, routs, masquerades, soirees, musicales. At this point, if she never saw another ballroom, theater, or pleasure garden, she would not mourn the loss. Normally she enjoyed the whirl of the season, but without Juliet, everything seemed different. Juliet, Lily, and Fallon were no longer the three diamonds. Now it was only Lily and Fallon, and they both missed Juliet terribly. And if Fallon was honest, she envied Juliet. Who wouldn't envy a woman married to a wealthy duke who obviously adored her? Fallon had never really believed in love. Her father hadn't loved her mother. He'd used her charms to run scams or make ends meet. And her mother hadn't loved her father. She'd been a dim woman who needed a man to tell her what to do. Fallon hadn't loved either of her parents. She thought she'd fallen in love once, but the experience had taught her she'd been right all along. There was no such thing as love. Except when she looked at Juliet and her dangerous duke, Fallon wondered. She strode down the corridor toward her boudoir. Her booted feet made shushing sounds on the thick rug. And even though she was now quite used to living surrounded by opulence, she paused a moment to savor the plush rug, the paintings on the walls, the expensive upholstery on the Sheraton chairs she'd just passed, and the fine silk of her gown. She had no illusions as to how fortunate she was. Unlike the daughters of duchesses and earls Fallon often glimpsed at the theater or a ball, she had not grown up in such privileged circumstances. She had been lucky to have something to eat and shoes on her feet. She did not take any of this for granted. It could all be taken away from her with the snap of a finger if anyone ever found out who she really was. There was a reason the Prince Regent had dubbed her the Marchioness of Mystery. No one, save Lady Sinclair, Juliet, and Lily, knew the truth about her. The Taunt was greatly diverted by conjecturing as to her true identity. Some said she was the daughter of a Maharaja. Little did they know, Fallon had been obliged to ask Lady Sinclair for the definition of Maharaja. Other rumors hinted she was a gypsy queen or a princess from a secret kingdom. Fallon wished there was a tiny kernel of truth in but one of the rumors. Anything was better than the reality. She opened the door of her boudoir and stepped inside. Strange. Usually Anne had the fire roaring and several candles lit, but the room was dark and cold. Fallon shivered, crossed to her bed, and pulled the cord to summon her lady's maid. She reached out and felt the edge of her bed. The soft silk of her counterpane felt light and inviting as a cloud. Fallon rolled her neck, then sank down onto her bed.
Ouch!
She bolted upright and stifled a scream. There was a man in her bed. An uninvited man. 2. Warwick Fitzhugh did not relish an audience with the Queen.
He did not know how it was he'd become her personal lackey, and he didn't give a bloody farthing. All he knew was the woman was mad. Daft as a resident of Bedlam, if he was any judge. And people claimed the king was mad. Well, those people hadn't met the queen. He sat in his club and rubbed his temples. Warwick had no problem taking orders. He'd been taking them from the Secretary of the Foreign Office for years, but now the Queen's cousin had been killed, and she wanted to give orders too. It wasn't as though Warwick wasn't already investigating the death of his fellow diamond in the rough. He'd been turning every stone he could find for weeks now. He might be retired from the Foreign Office, but he wasn't going to leave his friend's murder unavenged. Warwick supposed that spending the rest of his days acting the profligate his father always assumed him to be would have to wait. And so Fitzhugh sat at White's and waited for Pelham to meet him for their appointment. He resisted checking his pocket-watch and instead surveyed the club. It was filled with the usual stoop-shouldered, gray-haired men with gnarled fingers turning crisply iron pages of the Times. Earlier, Warwick had noted his father, the Earl of Winthorpe, seated in his usual chair near a painting of Charles II and his various dogs. Warwick glanced over again and met his father's gaze. Warwick lifted his glass and saluted. His father gave him a stony look and lifted his paper again. Warwick drank from his glass, since it was raised anyway, and wondered if his father was going to blame him for the rest of his life. It wasn't as though Warwick hadn't tried to stop Edward. They'd all tried to stop Edward from joining the military. Impatient now, Warwick pulled out his pocket watch. Pelham was never late. But he was also a newly married man. He had been less than enthusiastic about leaving his bride to meet Warwick. But Warwick had insisted most persuasively. And he could be very persuasive when necessary, as evidenced by the sight of Pelham striding into the dining room. His clothing was perfectly in order, his blue eyes clear and hard, his mouth set in a firm slash. But something was different about the man. Warwick narrowed his eyes. Pelham's hair, perhaps? It appeared a bit tousled. He rose when his friend spotted him, and didn't hide his grin.
"What are you looking so cheerful about?"
the Duke asked, taking a seat without being invited.
"Do I look cheerful?"
Warwick sat, signaling to the waiter to bring the port he had already requested. It was a vintage Warwick knew Pelham liked.
"Have you done something different?"
Pelham glanced at him sharply and shifted. Oh, now Warwick was going to enjoy this. Making Pelham uncomfortable was one of the few joys he had in life.
"Your coat cut differently?"
He pretended to study Pelham's conservative coat.
"Your cravat tied in a new sort of knot?"
He reached out and touched the perfectly tied neckcloth, perfectly tied in the same fashion Pelham had always worn it.
"No, that isn't it."
"Stubble it, Fitzhugh. There's nothing different."
"Oh, I think there is."
He looked pointedly at Pelham's hair, and could all but see the Duke leaning back in his chair away from Warwick's scrutiny.
"It's your hair. Why, Pelham, it's positively fashionable."
"My hair is exactly the same. Now why the devil did you call me here?"
"I don't believe so."
The waiter set the port in front of Pelham, and Fitzhugh waved the man away.
"It looks a bit tousled. That's how the dandies are wearing it these days."
Pelham slapped the table with his palm.
"I'm no bloody dandy. Stop looking at my hair."
"Can I assume this is the new Duchess of Pelham's doing?"
Fitzhugh asked, with a satisfied smile.
"I don't wish to discuss my hair, if that's the only topic you want to converse about."
He stood, and Warwick yanked him back down.
"What the devil are you about?"
Pelham adjusted his sleeve.
"Have you gone quite mad?"
"No. I have a serious matter to discuss with you." Pelham narrowed his eyes.
"It had better not be the state of my cravat."
"No. I fear we must suspend our fashion discussions for the moment. I need to ask you about one of your wife's friends. One of the Three Diamonds." Pelham drank his previously untouched port, swallowed, then said,
"Why?"
"I'm not at liberty to discuss that. I can say it's a matter of state."
"I thought you'd retired from the Foreign Office."
"On occasion, I am still called upon to exercise my skills."
"I see.
What do you know about the Marchioness of Mystery? She calls herself Fallon, I believe." Pelham shrugged.
"Not much. She's not as friendly as Lily."
"She's secretive," Warwick remarked. Pelham sipped his port.
"I don't know that I'd say that, but I don't believe all that rot about her being foreign royalty or a gypsy queen."
"No, that's rubbish," Warwick murmured.
"How do you know? I don't think Juliet even knows where Fallon came from. And what does a courtesan have to do with a matter of state?"
"I'd love to discuss that with you, old chap."
"But you can't." "Well, I will tell you this. I don't know who you're looking for, but if it's a spy or a traitor, looking at Fallon is looking in the wrong direction."
Warwick leaned forward. "Go on."
"She's fiercely loyal, to her friends and to the Countess of Sinclair. The last time I saw her, she told Juliet she was relieved this business with Lucifer was over and done. She said he was—"
Pelham rubbed his fingers together, obviously searching his memory for the exact words. Warwick appreciated his friend's effort to be precise, but then again, he expected nothing less from the orderly Duke of Pelham.
"Ah, she said Lucifer was a thorn in the side of the city, and had been for years. Struck me as rather patriotic."
A tingle ran up Warwick's spine, all the way to the base of his skull, and then down his arms. So this Fallon knew of Lucifer. That was interesting, because the very existence of the man was not common knowledge among anyone who did not frequent London's gambling hells. And those were certainly not the usual haunts of glittering courtesans like the Three Diamonds. Pelham didn't know it. But by trying to defend his wife's friend, he just confirmed everything Warwick had learned, thereby dooming her.
"I had better be going," Pelham said, rising. "We are leaving early in the morning. I told Juliet I'd take her to Bath."
"One more thing." Warwick rose. "Has the Duchess, your wife, ever called Fallon by any other name? Besides the Marchioness of Mystery?"
"Not in my hearing. Do you want me to ask Juliet if Fallon has another name?"
"No. Don't say anything. In fact, I'd prefer it if you kept the topic of this meeting to yourself."
"Of course. Good luck with your search, Fitzhugh."
"Thank you. Godspeed." Warwick watched Pelham stroll out of his club. The man was obviously in a hurry to return to his bride. And why shouldn't he be? He was married to one of the most beautiful and notorious women in London. Someone, Warwick suspected the girls themselves, had put it about that the Prince Regent gave them their sobriquets. Juliet had been the Duchess of Dalliance before becoming a legitimate duchess and Pelham's wife. Lily was the Countess of Charm. And Fallon, the one he sought, was the Marchioness of Mystery. Warwick thought the Marchioness might not be such a mystery after all. Warwick gave his father a salute, which the Earl ignored, and strolled out of his club. 2 days later, Warwick had been to more social events than he normally attended in a year. Fallon appeared to have boundless energy. She and her counterpart, the Countess of Charm, went everywhere and knew everyone. He did not know when they slept, because they danced until after 4 in the morning, and then began making calls or receiving callers at 10. What Warwick did know was that, for a courtesan, Fallon was remarkably difficult to corner. He had tried, quite unsuccessfully, on several occasions to get her alone. It had proved impossible. And so tonight he had been left with no other recourse but to adjourn to the one place he knew he could have a private conversation, her boudoir. Warwick had been impressed with her staff, in particular her giant butler. The man had almost caught Warwick as he wound his way through Fallon's townhouse and up to her private chambers. Once in her chambers, he'd had to deal with Fallon's lady's maid. He'd bound her and stashed her comfortably in Fallon's rather large dressing room, and then he'd returned to wait. And wait. He didn't know at what point he'd decided to lie down on the bed. He'd only known he was weary and wanted to close his eyes for a few moments. He didn't expect to sleep. He rarely slept. But he'd been startled from a light doze when something, rather, someone, sat on him. He realized immediately what had happened. She had not seen him in the dark room. To her credit, when she jumped up, she did not scream. He heard the hasty intake of breath, but she seemed able to control the impulse to utter a blood-curdling screech. "It's about time you came to bed," Warwick said. It was too dark to see his pocket watch, but he gauged the time close to 5 in the morning. "I've been waiting for hours."
"Oh, how rude of me," she said, her voice quite low and husky in the shadowed room. He could hear her fumbling about, and realized she probably sought her tinderbox. "To keep an uninvited man waiting." A moment later, a spunk blazed to life, and she lit one of the lamps beside the bed.
Upon seeing him, her brow creased. He was obviously not who she expected, and she was not what he expected. He'd seen her more times than he could count, but he'd rarely been this close to her, and when he had, he'd not been looking at her, but planning how to best monopolize her attention. Now she was an arm's length away, and for once not surrounded by an army of admirers. Warwick realized she was impossibly beautiful. But of course she was beautiful. He'd known that. Everyone knew that. She had lustrous, chocolate-brown hair and dark brown eyes. Her skin was the color of burnished gold, and her body far more voluptuous than was the current style. But what man ever favored a Greek statue? A man wanted soft flesh and warm curves when he sank into a woman. And Warwick didn't know why the hell he was thinking of soft flesh at the moment. He was supposed to be working. But he hadn't anticipated the distraction of her mouth. It was wide and red and far too tempting. And then there was the tilt of her eyes, rather exotic, the way they turned up at the corners. No wonder people tossed about rumors she was a gypsy queen. Warwick's gaze wandered downward, and he had to take a fortifying breath. It was one thing to glimpse her body across a crowded ballroom. It was quite another to feel the heat from her, to see the rise and fall of the rounded flesh revealed by her neckline, to smell the scent, jasmine, or some exotic flower she wore, and to know, if he buried his face in her hair, that sweet scent would surround him.
"Get the hell out of my bed," she said, in a velvet voice that only made him desire her more.
Warwick didn't even sit.
"I have a few questions for you." "Get out, or I'll call my butler and have you thrown out."
"I don't think so." He put his hands behind his head and leaned back on her prodigious pile of pillows. They were satin and velvet.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?